is a harder emotion to deal with in practice. It's a big issue. Every year, anxiety disorders affect about 40 million Americans, which is 18% of the population, and the rest of us are certainly no strangers to it. I mean, we've all known what it's like to be awake at 3:30 in the morning, worrying about money, a lot of people these days, money, your health or relationships, and feeling just a lot of dread and anxiety. Anyone not ever experienced that? How many people have never experienced that? I mean, see how common this is. And it's such an incredibly lonely feeling, isn't it? I mean, when you're alone with your anxiety, I almost feel like I am completely alone in a hostile universe. You know, and then you try to make yourself go to sleep, and you can't, and then you get mad at yourself, and you try to talk yourself out of it. You know, you're worried about nothing, stop it. So the inner critic gets activated, right? And that helps a lot, right? There's no anxiety state that the inner critic can't make worse, right? But we do it anyway. We get mad at ourselves, and then in a sense we join the enemy. If the universe is hostile and I'm hostile to myself too, you begin to feel more and more like a helpless child, and you know, the anxiety can just spiral. This familiar? I mean, this is most of us have experienced this. Many of us experience it a lot. One of the things that's interesting. Oh, so what I want to do tonight is a guided meditation. We're going to do another meditation in a few minutes. This will be briefer, maybe 5-10 minutes, to give a sort of a taste of how I'm trying to work with anxiety personally and professionally. So I'll do that in a minute. But first, I wanted to talk about the fact, what anxiety is, the fact that we are built, we are designed, in quote, to feel anxiety as a species. Here's a thought experiment which Rick Hansen, author of Buddha's Brain, uses. Here are two mistakes. Consider which one is the most dangerous mistake to make. Mistake number one, you think there's a tiger in the bushes, and so you run away. But in fact, there isn't a tiger there. Okay? Mistake number two, you think there isn't a tiger in the bushes, but there is, and you're lunch, right, if you walk by. So which mistake is more dangerous? It's pretty obvious, right? I mean, you don't have to think about it too much. The first mistake, you know, if you are fearful and anxious and run away, you may still live to pass your genes on. But if you are not anxious and there really is danger, you may be lunch. So this shows really why in evolution we evolved to experience a lot more anxiety than we actually need to survive. I mean, isn't that interesting? It was biologically inevitable. It's logical, you know, that we feel anxiety. Rick Hansen, again, he calls this part of the brain's negativity bias. The brain has a bias in favor of negative experiences. That's because it isn't an organ for dispassionately studying reality. It's a tool which evolved to anticipate and overcome dangers, protect us from pain, and solve problems. So dangers, pain, and problems are what capture its attention. It's pretty clear. Negative experiences set our alarms going. Positive experiences take longer even to register in the body. Rick Hansen sums it up this way. He says, the brain scans for, reacts to, stores, and recalls negative information about oneself and one's world. The brain is like Velcro for negative experiences and Teflon for positive ones. it's kind of depressing when you think about it. So the consequences, this reminds me, this is off the subject, but anyway, it reminds me of, I was at a retreat with Sylvia Boorstein not long ago. It was a summer day, and the deer were coming down, and you could hear the turkeys clucking and going through their weird mating ritual. And she was about to send us out for a walking meditation. She said, I'll give you all a koan for the meditation if you want to do it. She said, go out and focus on the turkeys. Watch them carefully and ask yourself the question, what was God thinking? I was impressed that she used the G word at a Buddhist retreat, but also I thought, when I read about the findings in neuroscience, and I look at how the human brain is constructed, and you know, sometimes I think the same. What was God thinking? We evolved to survive, not to be happy, contented, and joyful. The mind does not naturally incline toward these experiences, and that's a Buddhist term, of course. Inclining the mind, the concept that we can incline the mind, is one of the foundations of Buddhist psychology, that we have that, because we have this, we've also evolved this neocortex, which has some capacity for intention, we can move the brain. There's a neuroplasticity. How we use the brain affects its actual structure. So we have some capacity to incline the mind away from our natural bias toward negativity, which is what makes practice of any kind possible for our species. Some of the consequences of the brain's negative bias here's some of the research that begins to be explained. It's easy to acquire a feeling of learned helplessness, which is an important component of depression, from just a few failures. But it's hard to undo these feelings, even with many successes. People will do more to avoid a loss than to acquire a comparable gain. From John Gottman's work on relationships, in intimate relationships, it typically takes about 5 positive interactions to overcome the effects of a single negative one. The importance of right speech. We are inclined, we have a susceptibility to anxiety, each and every one of us, and probably most or all of us have more of it in our lives than we actually need to get through life. The brain is about 600 million years old. It's been evolving for that long, and the threat system was one of the first things to evolve. So it's way back there in your what's called your lizard brain. You know, you have the lizard brain, where you have reptilian, paleomammalian, neomammalian, and human brains. We've got 4 brains. They evolve and they stack on top of each other. When new equipment evolves, it just sits on top of the old stuff. It doesn't replace it. So, in a sense, you've got a lizard, a squirrel, and a monkey in your head every day. It's when you go out, you know. No wonder it's so hard to be human, you know? What was God thinking? So, the first conclusion to come to, I think, about anxiety from a Buddhist perspective has to do with right understanding. We, especially Americans in our individualistic culture where the inner critic is so profoundly hurtful, we blame ourselves when we suffer, don't we? I mean, we tend to think, if I had life figured out, I wouldn't suffer. I mean, it's very natural to think that. That's why the Buddha's first noble truth is so vitally important to understand, that suffering is inevitable no matter what you do or how you live. And anxiety is not your idea. It has this 600 million year history of evolution. So right understanding, I think, in this area is to understand that your anxiety isn't yours. it isn't your fault. You didn't think it up. You didn't create it. It's there. It's part of the heritage we've all inherited from basically from the fact that animals have this very annoying habit of eating one another. And we all had to develop threat systems to avoid predator. I mean, that's basically how anxiety began. So one of the things I've noticed is that it's when I started teaching mindfulness to psychotherapy patients, the depressed patients I noticed responded much better as a rule than the anxious ones. Not all the time, but in general. And I notice this myself. When I'm depressed, I can sit often and be mindful of it and even kind of compassionate toward it. But if I'm anxious, you know, it's very hard to sit still. The adrenaline's flowing in the body, right? The cortisol, the stress hormone is being secreted. And the purpose of all of this activity is to get you to... fight, flight, or freeze. Do one of those three things. It compels you to action, and to sit and try to be mindful, for many of my clients, is torturous. I think people who've practiced for a while can do this. At this point, I can meditate through mild anxiety. But that's after a lot of practice, and it's very hard to do. And in fact, I have had clients report to me that they thought practicing mindfulness made it worse. I began thinking more about this when I would just teach it. I mean, it's a calming activity. It makes you feel, you know. But in fact, when people are anxious, trying to meditate, trying to force themselves to practice will often make them feel more anxious. It's a paradoxical result. And I remember talking about this with one man who had been going to the Zen Center. He'd get up every morning at 5 and go to the Zen Center and meditate. He had an anxiety disorder. And he tried to, you know, he was committed. But after, not committed, he was committed to his practice. He said it made him worse. His anxiety was worse. In his case, I began to understand one way, one reason, and it has to do with the term mindfulness, which has mind in it. And to many of us, mind connotes thinking. And I think to many people who are new to mindfulness practice, mindfulness, they think it means a sort of detached, aloof attitude, separate from what's happening. This is not what it is, but I think it's easy to see how you can get that idea. Has anyone ever? I mean, this was how I first began to see it, as a sort of a separating practice. Well, if you're anxious and you already feel separate and alone in a hostile universe, a practice of separating yourself from your experience will feel even more isolating, won't it? That wrong understanding of practice isn't going to help. It's interesting Howie told me that in the Pali language, the term for mind and the term for heart are the same word, citta. Originally there was no sense of a separation. Your mind and your heart were located here, right? So it occurred to me, what if instead of describing the practice as mindfulness, we started thinking of it as heartfulness? I sneak that into the meditation instructions a little bit. Be heartful towards your experience, because in fact, they mean the same thing. You know, mindfulness does not mean a dispassionate, separative kind of awareness. Awareness is never separated from its contents. There's no distance between what you're aware of and the awareness that is aware of it. And it is interesting how when the mind opens, the heart opens as well. So what I have been doing lately is teaching clients heartfulness practice. And I've been thinking of that more myself. Because when I'm trying to be heartful, I immediately notice what is the attitude I'm taking toward my experience. I think when we suffer, when we're anxious, depressed, or whatever, angry, it's very easy to have a subtle, aversion toward it, and a judgment of it, and of ourselves for feeling it. But if I'm remembering that I'm trying to be heartful, then I'm trying not to be simply aware of what I'm experiencing. I'm remembering what is the attitude I'm taking toward it. Is the attitude hostile? Am I hostile toward myself, or am I accepting and compassionate? I think that's a clue to how we can work with anxious states. So, let's do a little guided meditation. You don't have to change your position or get all stiff and meditative for this one. This is a variation on loving kindness meditation, which you can do in a relaxed state. You can cross your legs if you want. Just sit in a way that you can sit for 5 or 10 minutes in a relaxed place. And don't close your eyes yet, because I got some instructions. What this is. I have just found this useful I'm still experimenting with how to work with anxiety, but this practice is a Tibetan version of loving kindness meditation, which instead of using phrases like may I be happy, may I be peaceful, you use imagery, which appeals, I think, to the more primitive aspects of the brain, the visual centers. It's a little more, I think, powerful for dealing with anxious states. So I'd like to try it, and I'd actually like to hear from folks what you think, because this is all fairly new for me too. I'm learning as I go. So to do this meditation, you have to think of some what the Tibetans call benefactors. And your benefactors are just people who love you or who have loved you. You can use spiritual beings like the Buddha or Ramana Maharshi, but they can be friends, they can be family members. And they don't have to be people who love you perfectly forever, but just people who you have felt at least at some point some sense of unconditional regard and love from them, some compassion from them. You can use imaginary beings. You can use pets. When I do this meditation, there's this dog that I used to know named Samantha, and she's always there in my meditation because she loved me absolutely unconditionally. Just take a minute and just think of a few benefactors. One is enough, two or three is good. Just some people and beings who you can feel that they love you unconditionally. Okay? And then when you have that, gently close your eyes. And sit in a fairly relaxed place and imagine that your benefactors are above you and behind your head, watching you with compassion. They're sending you love in the form of compassion. And receive the healing radiance like a soft rainfall. Let their compassion soak into any physical pain you're feeling, allowing your body to relax. Now, bring to mind some worries and anxieties you may have about your daily life. You might start by thinking of your worries over finances, security, or meeting your personal obligations. just remember what that feels like in your body, that sharp pang of anxiety. And then let the energy of compassion from your benefactors soak right into it, go right into the center of your anxiety. Not to alter it in any way, not to make it go away, but to love it and love you in your anxiety, in your suffering. See yourself as receptive, like a puppy lying on a rug in the sunlight, letting the warm radiance of loving kindness to soak in. Now bring to mind any anxieties you may have about how others are perceiving you or judging you. Making it real, recalling how you actually experience such anxieties. Let yourself focus on where you feel it in your body. And again, the radiance of your benefactor's compassion goes right into the center of it. You breathe it into the center of your anxiety. Your benefactors radiate this love, and you might imagine that as you breathe in, you just absorb it, so that when you breathe deeply, the love and compassion go right to the center of your being. Now bring to mind any feelings of self-doubt or inadequacy or maybe guilt feelings that you may have. Again, experiencing them authentically as they actually are in your mind and body. And then let the soft, warm rain of the loving compassion of your benefactors penetrate it, fall into it. Let your body and mind absorb that loving compassion. Bring to mind any fears you have of illness, injury, or just your fear of dying. That terror we all have. Allow it to be as it is. Allow it to be seen as it is by your benefactors. Allow yourself to be loved in the midst of it by your benefactors. going just a little further, receive compassion into your deepest patterns of clinging to self. And completely surrender to compassion by letting go of the visualization and merging with the energy of compassion itself. Merge with luminous wholeness beyond separation between self and others, deeply letting everything be just as it is. Notice any grasping in the body and let it be, let it go. Surrendering to the natural power of the body to embody you. Let the breath come into its natural power, breathing all the way in and all the way out. Breathing in compassion, breathing out radiant compassion. Let the mind unfurl and fall completely open, free, all pervasive. Sense the boundless openness of awareness without boundaries, infinite openness and translucence, pervasive, open like the sky. And let that meditate you. Feel the power of your natural mind to contain and understand all that is in a field of loving kindness and awareness. When you know the suffering in yourself, you can instantly sense it in others. And when you know this place of freedom in yourself, you can uphold that in others. I'd like to hear any questions, comments, what that was like for anybody who'd like to share. Back there. Would it be possible for you to stand up so people can hear?
Like this, that when I'm imagining
Mm-hmm. How does that work for you? Oh, probably. You're doing it right if it works. You know, and the idea that you may be doing it wrong is, how many people have never had that idea about their meditation, that they're meditating wrong? That's really great. That's the first time anyone's ever said, congratulations. So the inner critic, we begin to wonder whether we're doing things right. For some people, visualizations don't work at all. Phrases work better. And for some people, it's the other way around. I think what you need to do is just let your own experience guide you. Not worry whether you're doing it right. That's an external standard you'd be comparing yourself to. Does it make you feel more spacious, more relaxed, more less anxious, or not? If it does, then it's the right thing to be doing. Does that help? Yeah. Okay. Yes. That, yeah. Did everyone hear that? She was saying that she's done loving kindness meditation where you do phrases, and this meditation where there was a visualization seemed more powerful. It seemed to get in deeper, and also there was a sense of not being alone. Well, that's why I've been doing this kind of meditation with people I work with, rather than straight loving kindness meditation, because the loving kindness meditation is phrases and they can be very helpful, but it's still you thinking, you know, so maybe sending out energy, receive, but it can be a very isolating experience for someone who's already feeling isolated, because if I'm right that anxiety involves feeling alone in a hostile universe, then the way to treat it is to begin accessing our affiliative systems, which are in the mammalian brain, new hardware. Letting our capacity for compassion get activated through actually imagining our relationships with other people or spiritual beings, and letting that visualization evoke it. And then you send the energy into the anxiety, but without any effort or intention to make the anxiety go away, right? The instruction is you send love into the heart of the anxiety exactly as it is. That's very important. And you don't do it with ulterior motives. Right, you don't do it with the hope that it will. If I do this, it'll go away, because it knows. Right. You actually are practicing acceptance of yourself exactly as you are through this, through the ritual, through the heuristic device of this meditation, and it has to be done sincerely. You'll be next.
Unexpected email from somebody reflecting about our experience together 25 years ago. And it dawns on me that was a message from a benefactor that, you know, I could have given more time to that and let that kind of rain on me to kind of bring some ease. And so this exercise really makes me really think about taking those gifts in as they appear, you know, unprovoked.
Thank you. Yeah, another practice that this reminded me of is that Rick Hansen talks about in Buddha's Brain, which is a great book. If you haven't read it, read it. It goes farther into this, into the neurology of these things. The practice he recommends is taking in the good, where you actually focus on good things in your life like this and breathe them in so that you incline the mind toward acceptance of the positive, because we actually have to attend to the positive in order to overcome the inclination of the mind to focus on the negative. So, and that this practice does some of that. Yes. Yeah, anyone, is that it? Okay. Yeah, and this is a meditative device. So the being can be a fictional character, an imaginary friend, someone, you know, someone, one of my benefactors is somebody I spent about 20 minutes with years ago. Someone I just remember very well, where I had a great connection. And a dog, in my case, this beautiful dog, Samantha. She's always there, and she always calms me down, you know. So it doesn't really matter who you. It all that matters is that it work. In the back. Oh, it did. So it helped to some degree. Yeah. Interesting. A row of Jesuses flinging butter at you. I love it. Well, you know, for Christians, the sense of the presence of Jesus. This will work. I think that's why. That's such a powerful belief system, because the sense of the presence of Jesus. I'm not pushing Christianity here, please, but I'm just trying to understand that this works. This sort of thing works. The other thing is that you saw your mind at work. Your mind was berating yourself. I think in the meditation, when you notice that, just one thing you can do is notice this cruel mind. I mean, our minds are cruel, you know. Peace of mind is an oxymoron, right? There is no such thing. There's peace and there's the mind. Anyway, but you see this cruel mind for as it is, and let it sink into your heart, and let this mind be loved by your benefactors. You might try that as a practice. And remember also that this mind that's berating you is actually trying to help you. Believe it or not, it's trying to make you do it right. And it thinks that that's what it needs to do. It didn't come out of thin air, you know. And it's not very skillful, but even this mind that's doing this is a sign of the love you bear for yourself. So those kind of reflections, I think, can help with it. We're going to have to stop in a minute. I just wanted to say thank you for putting up with me tonight, and I think, thank you for loving me, Registin. Yes, okay. I learned something just now.
We need to find reliable refuges. They talked about how he had that whole story about freaking out at whatever retreat in Boston, how he didn't have hold of himself. And it's finally, I finally figured out through coming to this group how to care for myself and how to hold myself and how to provide that kind of love for myself. And I'm one of my benefactors.
Wonderful, yeah.
Destined to be, that can just be a perfect, flawless, maternal nurturing, all the things that might have been won't allow me because it's down the road and I'll never get it. So having myself be one of my benefactors.
That's a wonderful idea. Did you hear? Using your, seeing yourself as one of your benefactors. I think that I'm going to experiment with that one myself. I think that's a really, that we have that power to be our own benefactor. So there's going to be a couple of announcements. I have one. In the introduction, it was mentioned that I write this column called The Examined Life that's published in The City. The last two articles were on this subject of anxiety and kind of went over the same material. And if anyone wants to receive it, I put up a sign-up sheet over there next to the Donna Bowl. You just put your name and your email address on it, and what will happen is that you'll get my column every other week. I promise you won't get any advertisements or any political rants or any cute puppy pictures or anything like that. You'll just get the column. And well, thank you very much. It's been a really pleasure for me to be here.
Thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it. Everyone, I think, just expressed that. It was beautiful. I have a couple of announcements. The first one is we have a long-time Sangha member who needs a ride to the sunset. If anybody's, you need the ride, right? And can anybody offer him a ride out to the sunset? Somebody going in that direction? Yay! There's somebody back there. If you guys see each other, thanks so much. Next, I wanted to let everybody know that we recorded the talk tonight, and it'll be on our Mission Dharma website. If a few of you don't know about the website, it is missiondharma.org, so you can check that out. We've been recording the talks since about August, so all of those talks are up on the website. Howie will be back next week, and I think he'll be here for quite a while, so Tom is our last substitute for a while. We've enjoyed our substitutes over the last 3 weeks. And it'd be great to have Howie back. And lastly, I just wanted to talk a little bit about Donna. Donna is the practice of generosity. And in the Buddhist tradition, we don't charge anybody to come listen to teachings. We don't charge to share meditation techniques. The teachers teach out of a great joy and a great passion for the teachings and what they've learned and can see in their own lives and in the lives of others how these teachings have helped so many individuals, as a couple of people mentioned tonight. So what we can do in order to help the teachers is offer our generosity. And you can do that by offering money in the basket over on the organ bench. I think somebody's in front of it there. And also, it costs us $150 every week to rent this church, and that donor can be offered over in the on the organ bench as well. So we thank you so much for being here. Thanks everybody else for being here. This is a wonderful turnout, and we look forward to having you here again in the future. Thanks so much.
Oh, dedication to merit.
Would you like to do that?
Sure.
Okay.
Don't usually end.
Yes, that'd be wonderful.
It's customary to end with a brief dedication of merit. May any benefits that we acquired in our shared practice tonight be for the benefit, for the liberation of all beings everywhere. May all beings know freedom from separation. May all beings live in compassion and love. May all beings awaken. Thank you very much.